Good morning. I'm going to go ahead and open up the Joint Committee on Legislative Council Subcommittee on Public Records, dealing with basically House Bill 2101. And I thank everyone that's here. What we're going to do is we're going to ask Dexter Johnson to please come forward to kind of give us an overview. This is an informational meeting dealing with the review of policies that implemented the 2017 public records legislation that we passed. And so, Dexter, if you could help us and kind of give us a guideline as to where we're at, which way we're going to move forward.
Sure. Co-Chair Przanski, Co-Chair Wilson, Senator Boquist, good morning. Dexter Johnson, Legislative Council. And just to begin with, I'd like to give a little background on the subcommittee and kind of the unusual things that I'm asking you to do this morning. So the subcommittee was created in 2017 legislation, House Bill 2101, and the main role of the subcommittee is to serve essentially as a liaison between the legislature and the Sunshine Committee, another entity that was created in the 2017 legislation. The Sunshine Committee's role is to take a look at public records exemptions and other related laws and make recommendations to the legislature to consider modifying, eliminating, or extending. And your role is to essentially bring their message forward so that the legislature considers those recommendations. That said, this committee, this current meeting is to simply give deliberation to staff on what to do involving certain policies that may be needed to implement other aspects of the 2017 public records legislation as it relates to the legislative branch itself and how we process public records requests. So you are a subcommittee of the Legislative Council Committee. That committee, of course, provides direction and oversight of the Office of Legislative Council and me as Legislative Council. And as you may recall, in January 2018, the LCC met, and at that time I presented the policies you have before you to them, along with a couple of other non-controversial policies. The two that were non-controversial, one involved what the open government impact statement would look like. That is, the 2017 legislation directed Legislative Council to prepare open government impact statements for every measure, and every measure that's reported out of committee. And that policy established what those would look like. Also a policy on how requesters are supposed to make a request of the legislative branch needed in order to facilitate the accelerated timelines that the 2017 legislation established for public records. Those were adopted. The policies you have before you were looked at a very high level by the LCC, but they didn't take any action on that, and further legislative deliberation on those policies is warranted. And this is kind of the task of the subcommittee this morning, is to look at in a little bit more detail in that. And then I plan on taking those policies as modified, perhaps to reflect the discussion this morning or other comments you may have. But anyways, to take those policies to the LCC when it will convene in the September legislative days for adoption at that point. So that's kind of the task this morning. Any questions about that? All right, then, Mr. Chair, would you like to direct us to move on to one of the policies?
Yeah, I think that's fine. And Dexter, why don't you stay there? Karen, I understand you may have an intro for us. I think for the record, let's just say which one we're starting with so we have that
So that would be policy 142-111.
And that policy sets forth drafting measures for drafting standards for measures that will establish or modify public records exemptions from disclosure.
And so the Dexter Johnson Legislative Council, that policy implements a provision of the 2017 legislation that directed Legislative Council in the open government impact statement to identify with respect to a particular measure whether it conformed with drafting standards. As of to date, we don't have specific drafting standards for public records exemptions. We have, of course, ones that apply to all measures. This policy would implement those, would establish standards. And you see the four standards that we have there. And Cameron, do you want to talk a little bit further about what those specific standards are?
Sure. The first one is that when possible, we should modify or expand an existing exemption rather than create a new exemption. There are approximately 550 different public records exemptions, which there's issues. The people have had issues with us, with the legislature, continually creating new exemptions without seeing if we can do a comprehensive exemptions rather than doing it piecemeal. The second one is the exemption should be narrowly tailored to exclude only exclude documents and portions of documents that the exemption is meant to exclude from public disclosure. The measure should state specifically the harm that would be caused by disclosure. The reason for this is that when courts interpret exemptions, when they do a public interest test, they need to measure see what we're trying to protect and what we're not trying to protect. If an exemption is to be available only to certain public bodies or categories of public bodies, the measure should so specify. Is the third one, and then the final one is, unless disclosure is otherwise prohibited or contained within a section that has a public interest test, the exemption should contain a public interest test.
All right, Brian.
Okay, so let's go back to three, right? If an exemption is to be available only to certain public bodies or categories, the measure should so specify. Try giving us a layman's example. I think Mr. Wilson and I are not attorneys. And then the next one is can you give us an example of the exemption should contain a public interest test? I'm not a really good tester. I think I took algebra three times and calculus twice to get my master's degree. So help us with examples of three and four so us lay people and the public watching us can understand what it is. I think I understand what you're saying, but it'd be helpful for an example. As we hit in revenue, because we're not being counters in revenue. They've got to kind of like block one, block two equals block three. So help us here.
So, for example, the courts have certain addresses of individuals that might be protected individuals.
Mm-hmm.
We might want to protect only those addresses, but not the addresses that Motor Vehicle Department has.
Okay.
And so we'd want to say, oh, you can't provide addresses. Well, we need to specify which address. If you're trying to protect only the court's addresses of protected individuals, you need to say it's only applies to the court. Or if you want to say, or you need to maybe specify that you're talking about the protected addresses regardless of who has them, but you need to be specific as to what you're trying to protect and who needs to protect that information.
Okay.
Another example of that would be, so you have to protect the people that are on that list of protected individual by the courts. If you leave that wide open and Motor Vehicle Department doesn't know who's protected, has a protected address, they might inadvertently release a protected address without knowing because they weren't exempted from that when they release multiple addresses. So the public interest test usually, you state why you're trying to protect a document. Something like a social security number is obvious, but maybe not trade secrets, or an application for a tax credit might not be obvious what you're trying to protect in that application. And so to specify exactly what it is you're protecting and why you're protecting it, when you're weighing the public interest in, for example, knowing the source of information, that if a reporter's trying to find out why something was done and who did it, as opposed to trying to protect someone's private information. So that having to know how what that public interest test is and exactly who it's meant to protect allows the courts or the agency to weigh why is this something that we should really release or is this something that we should keep private?
So follow up, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. So I'm guessing that the public interest test, and I'm going to go back and give you an example there and spoon it back to you, is the public interest test is really sort of a set of examples because it's not really a test. In the case you used, the first example you used is that we're going to protect addresses for justices in the court. And in the law someplace, in lieu of or sort of the public interest test is going to be, in theory, we would be putting in there that we want the justices to be remain nonpartisan and non-partial, and we don't want people to be able to go to their address and either one, influence them, issue one, or two, because of a case, threaten harm at their address or their family. So you have two, basically, you've established an example using two test standards. One is impartiality, to make sure that the justices would be impartial and no one could go unduly influence them. And the second piece is one of physical harm from their case. So by using sort of an example like that, that's how you would create this public interest test?
So yes. In the second one, we want to say specifically that we're trying to protect their impartiality, we're trying to protect them from harm. The fourth one is that public interest test. We have blanket, you shall release this document unless, you shall exempt this document unless it should be released. It is by clear and convincing evidence the requester can show that the public interest requires disclosure in the particular instance, is usually how it's phrased. It doesn't spell out exactly what's in the test, and that's why in number two we're saying you should spell out what we're protecting, and four, you should say we are specifically going to protect it unless there's a public interest that requires otherwise.
Dexter.
Mr. Chair and members, I do want to mention one other thing, that these standards, this is more of a general comment, but these standards don't limit what a member can request. So you could, if you wanted a bill that did something that didn't conform with these standards, these don't limit that. They won't limit that. They merely will cause legislative counsel to, when it prepares the open government impact statement, to note that the standards aren't being conformed with. So it isn't a real restriction on what members can do. It simply does, potentially it's controversial because there is this other official document coming from legislative counsel that might flag a negative reason, which is an unusual role for us. So I just wanted to make sure everyone was aware that this wasn't really limiting what members can request. It's just changing the dynamics a little.
Well, I think most of the legislators have a lot of negative people who don't like us anyway, so I don't think we're concerned about that one. I think Representative Wilson has a question.
Yeah, wanted to ask about the four standards that we see here. Where did those come from specifically?
They're created by me mainly. They're based on discussions that have been had by the Oregon Sunshine Committee. Mm-hmm. They've based on discussions held by the I'm trying to remember the name of the committee, the old committee that looked at exemptions. There's been several committees that have examined these exemptions, mm-hmm. and these are some of the things that they take issue with some of the existing exemptions, that they're too vague. They don't have those tests.
What does the discussion look like then between the legislator and the lawyer in the LC when it comes to actually working to draft legislation? At what point in time do we expect the subject of nonconformance to these standards come up in the discussion that the legislator is having with the lawyer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wilson, I think the way the office is set up, Cameron will be exclusively responsible for preparing open government impact statements, but he has a unique role in LC, and he doesn't do any drafting. So all of the LC attorneys will be trained on this, and certainly my expectation and goal for the office would be that when a member is, or whoever we're authorized to work with is requesting something, mm-hmm. that we would flag, well, this doesn't conform with drafting standards. And that certainly is what we would strive for. I can't guarantee that that would always happen in a conversation when you're making a request for a particular bill.
Okay. So then the member who is requesting a bill might not be aware of a potential violation of this until this statement is affixed to the bill as it's reported out of committee.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wilson, that's correct. Even though one of the earlier policies that the Legislative Council Committee adopted actually has us preparing the impact statement earlier than when it's reported out of committee, but it's of course modified mm-hmm. to reflect any amendments in committee too.
So is it fair to say one of the goals is perhaps to have that legislative concept modified before it actually sees the light of day?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wilson, I actually don't think the timing I don't think it's going to line up that way, because the LC is prepared, it's delivered confidentially to the requester. Mm-hmm. And at some point between then and when it is introduced, Cameron will prepare an open government impact statement, but that won't appear on OLIS until mm-hmm. after it's the bill is introduced.
Okay. One final, if I might. And that would be, so if I'm grabbing this concept correctly, this statement is affixed to the bill when reported out of committee. What should the response be, or what would the reaction be to a member of the body who sees this bill, crosses his desk, and he sees this affixed to it? Should that be a warning to the legislator that this bill perhaps has a fatal flaw? What will the outcome be? I'm not sure where we go with that.
Yeah, Mr. Co-Chair, Co-Chair Wilson, it wouldn't be a fatal legal flaw, because the fact that something doesn't conform to particular drafting standards isn't a legal flaw.
Right.
It arguably gives ground to opponents of the bill as this is a reason not to vote for the bill, mm-hmm. and that's really why this drafting standard policy is a bit controversial, because it is the open government impact statement requirement, which was a statutory requirement in the 2017 legislation, is implicitly an exception from the rule, from the statute, longstanding statute, that directs legislative counsel never to take positions mm-hmm. on legislation. So right. that is why this policy is a bit controversial and warrants further legislative deliberation.
Thank you.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And since, of course, we're trying to put things on the record here and deliberate, I want to follow up on the good representative's point here. And I'll just, since the three of us are thrown into the fray, any one of the three of us, I see a not a fatal flaw, but a topic of discussion. Any one of the three of us could intend to make a change, but also our intention could be that we want to comply with the conformity situation, and any one of the three of us could unintentionally not comply, and through the blaze of amendments or whatever transpires on any given bill, like 18 amendments on Monday, not know or not catch until it is posted to the webpage that Senator Boquist is proposing this nonconformity, when in fact our intent was to conform, and as you've pointed out, it just bluntly on our end is now on the 6 o'clock news at KATU or KZD down to you, and then the Eugene newspaper, and that wasn't our intent at all. And I would just throw into the spectrum, having not been able to attend all the Sunshine Committee meetings because of a variety of reasons, like double scheduling at the moment, which I will clear up. But I think the contention of understanding what is the public interest test. I mean, I think most members who have not been attuned to the legalese or the court cases, you know, understanding what is a public interest test raises a flag too. But I would be concerned, and what I'm just thinking in my mind out loud here, Mr. Chair and colleagues, I mean, there are forms and blocks on amendments and things that we have now from the good legislative council office who does good work, in which says, you know, do you want this to be confidential or do you not want the confidential? I don't know. Maybe we ought to be having some intent put in there or something that, you know, we, our intention is that this conforms in some manner, because we could all be blindsided and it's too late. And that's not the intention to do it. And I don't think that's the intention of the proponents, some of which are sitting in the back of the room, by the way, that, you know, what they want to know is when we're doing monkey business. That's sort of the argument that I've heard in all these public records. Well, you guys are doing shenanigans with 500 and how many of these exemptions?
550.
550. So, I mean, I just kind of, I don't have a solution, but I do see that there is, it does raise a challenge for 90 different members, and certainly a challenge for all the drafters. Because if it's by the time it gets to good counsel's learned opinion here, and he's issuing the statement, is a little late to realize that Senator Boquist or Senator Brzezinski or Representative Wilson are now doing something they didn't intend to do, but that's what the 6 o'clock news just reported.
So during this past short session, we issued for about 11 or 12 bills, an open government impact statement stating we're creating a new exemption or modifying one. There was an initial positive statement, and then it was subsequently changed after the amendments. Some with the amendments became a positive impact after the fact. And there was some controversy over some of those. I know that with drafts become available starting in June or July, we will begin reviewing them, and we will be giving heads up to members when we see impacts.
That's what I was going to ask, is that when we get something back from LC, it's not uncommon to have a little white paper attached to it calling to our attention something. So in response to what Senator Boquist has brought up, will that be something that as a member we would be anticipating that when we get the draft I guess it would be the final draft that would be ready for submission into the hopper, that's when that cover letter usually comes. Mm-hmm. And at that point, Cameron, would you have had your eyes on it, or do we think that the drafters are going to have that expertise based on their training to say, oh, by the way, this may have this impact? Or
Mr. Co-Chair, I think we would strive to alert you well in advance, but it would be not Cameron, but the drafting attorney that would have that obligation. We certainly, if Cameron, I mean, we're going to be doing, just because of the sheer volume of work, we're going to be doing a lot of behind-the-scenes preparation of open government impact statements, potentially months in advance. And under those circumstances, we will build into our process some kind of a feedback loop so that the drafting attorney is aware of Cameron's views in advance. And that should allow for most of the time advance notice to be given to the member. But and we can't guarantee that at this point.
Follow up to that. Is there, what would be the reaction of learned counsel and learned drafter of this policy if we added a fifth block and a fifth drafting standard? Because this is basically a drafting standard that goes into the manual that says that the drafter will strive to inform the member of such pitfalls. Strive, not mm-hmm. required, strive, so that in a case of which, and I'll just use myself because I'm very good at, I can perfectly be stupid legislation without the help of this statement, as members know and the public knows, in which a case of where, you know, and I will make mental note to always put in there now that, you know, please make sure that it's not nonconforming in my drafter, is that we at our level can say, hey, you know, that wasn't our intent, or if you miss it, there's at least something in there that knows that, you know, of the 90 members, they might not all catch it, and this might not be intentional.
Mm-hmm.
which might soften some of the complaints you had in the February session. Because once again, I'm guessing this is going to go into the big, thick binder policy manual you already have. It just says, you know, please, as the drafter, strive to let the member know or the requester that this might not comply with the above aforementioned standards, which doesn't mean you're going to do it all the time, but then we at least have alerted the public and our colleagues that hopefully we'll catch it 90% of the time.
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Oquist, yes, we can certainly add that, and I will note that we actually have only a handful of these formal policies, but we can add that. I think that is certainly what we would strive to do anyways.
All right. I guess I'll just, I'm going to kind of go back to, I guess, square one. What we're looking at is if we propose something to be drafted by LC, and whatever it is, it would seem that we would be calling out in that proposal whether we want it to be exempt or not to be exempt. I'm just trying to figure out at what stage do we not have that being called out to the point of where Cameron's going to be looking at this and saying, oh, by the way, this looks like this would be some type of exemption. It seems like it would be, you know, remind me, I forget the statute number, I was trying to there, where you have for public record exemptions, where you have the balancing test on one and the other is completely prohibited.
Yes, there are those two big, huge statutes.
And then we have individuals. I know statutes that also call out on an individual statute, there's a prohibition or...
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I think that the problem, the reason why there are 550-some exemptions on the books is because actually a lot of those don't use the terminology exemption, and they arrive from some other issue that is being dealt with. Say, particular records that involve that are always involved in some kind of crime, and so the legislation addresses the criminal investigation, and it perhaps makes it these particular communications privileged or something like that, where you're. The public records context is not really the focus of the legislature when it considers that legislation. And that is, I think, how a number of these exemptions have actually come into being. And the open government impact statement process is designed to kind of thwart that creep.
Capture that, right.
Yeah. While I'm on that topic, actually, Mr. Chair, may I note, I had a conversation, I want to get this on the record, with the public records advocate about this last week. And she, about this is about the proposed drafting standards, and she noted that at the federal level, they have include in this kind of thing requirements that a particular measure in question use some kind of magic language, you know, specific language, this is a public records exemption, or a required statutory placement, for example, in with all the other public records laws. And the reason they do that at the federal level, she told me, was because to grant notice. Now, I have some concerns with either of those approaches. When you legislatively direct a statute to appear in a particular place in the ORS, you pick up a whole bunch of definitions or a whole bunch of penalties, that sort of thing, that might not be appropriate in a particular circumstance. And to have a particular phrase be in the proposal, that raises the issue, well, what happens if it wasn't in there? Does that make it invalid, that sort of thing? So there's going to be a court case or two struggling with that if that requirement is there. And it seems to me that for notice, that is the whole point of the open government impact statement process. So you kind of have the basis covered there. But I did want to put that conversation on the record.
Okay. Any questions or comments based on that?
Not particularly based on that, Mr. Co-Chair. Back to the public interest test again, number four. I guess my question is, are these 4 points undebatable when it comes to their use? Could a legislator and a drafter really be at loggerheads over the public interest test and the efficacy of a public interest test or a standardization, standard meaning of a public interest test from one body to another, one state to another. Again, can legislative counsel be seen as taking a position through the application of this? I hope I'm making myself plain there, but that's a concern that I have.
Taking a position, I think what I would anticipate is not a position. I mean, they're taking a position as to what they believe is the impact. They give us notice of that in our cover letter or shortly thereafter when it arises, I would think. I mean, there is nothing that has stopped us as individual members when we get a cover letter that says there may be an issue of constitutionality.
Right.
From not, that doesn't prohibit us from introducing it.
Mm-hmm.
But it does give you notice that if challenged, there is a likelihood that we may lose it in the courts mm-hmm. based on the challenge, you know.
Right.
And I would assume that there'd be similar type of concept as to saying, just beware that the way it's drafted, this would be putting it into a non-disclose and then the transparency issues mm-hmm. that Senator Boquist has brought up as to, well, we didn't intend to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But Dexter?
Mr. Co-Chair Wilson, that's a very good point. And I think there is implicit in this open government impact statement an exception to the normal statute that applies to us that says we can't take positions on legislation. The opinion situation, you've all received opinions from us that, you know, this or that is unconstitutional. That's different because those are confidential, and so we're not taking a public position, whereas this open government impact statement is very much more of a public statement. That's why I view this as implicitly an
right.
exception
Got
from
it.
The normal position that we do not take positions on legislation.
All right. Other comments? It sounds like on this particular one, which again is 142-111, there's a suggestion that we add a fifth guideline to strive to give notice to the requester as to whether there's a public records issue or disclosure exemption.
Okay. We'll take that into account in preparing the policy for
All right. Representative Power.
My apologies for being late. I have a new LA and she didn't calendar this committee on my schedule. It does. We were joking this morning that inevitably we were going to hit a calendar snag and we did. Did you discuss already the report forthcoming from the Sunshine Committee and attachments?
We have not as a group. Dexter and I talked briefly before we got started as to our process and procedure of what we are doing. As a subcommittee, my understanding is when we're vetting this right now, yeah. we're not actually going to be voting on anything as a subcommittee. They will take our directive, instructions, thoughts back and then finalize what will be presented to the full legislative council committee. Regarding the Sunshine Committee work, that I'm not sure how that would play into what we're doing right now, because my understanding that's ongoing. You're at the meeting, which I was
joined
in for
briefly.
10 minutes and
Thank
then back
you.
Out.
I mentioned it because when Dexter and I talked about some of these suggestions here around policy and procedures, the Sunshine Committee is itemizing sections within the law where they've seen the most issues, and I was trying to figure out a way to communicate to us and our colleagues so we know in advance we'll have this open government impact statement on bills that we get back, but I wanted to make sure that the work we do moving forward around bills is not an opposite with what the Sunshine Committee is working on at the same time in flagging things proactively. So they are going to be adding a table onto their report back to the legislature that more clearly indicates sort of the most frequent flyer contested areas. So I think that should dovetail well with these policies, because we should have, on one hand, results and some additional information that will help us to strengthen our drafting moving forward.
Okay. So since I was not able to attend that, is there a report date out time for the Sunshine Committee? And Dexter, maybe you should, for the record, clarify for me, is when that comes out, is that going, where does their report go? Is it coming to the subcommittee, or is it going to LCC?
Mr. Co-Chair, the report, when it comes out, is delivered to you. You deliberate on it and make a recommendation actually to LCC, and then it's, and LCC adopts the schedule of when particular exemptions are then going to be considered by substantive policy committees in session.
Okay. So on the dateline, then, more than likely, we will be having this subcommittee meeting in September to take up, hopefully, whatever the Sunshine Committee has put together, or I'm not sure what the timeline was for them.
I think they're wrapping their report up by July. I think that's when their deadline is, if I remember correctly. I just thought, you know, the more information we have when we're going into statute and enacting new policies around that, that they'd be simpatico at the same time, so they're not working at cross purposes.
Right. So, I mean, my thought, and I unfortunately think that we've uniformed our uniformity that we now have for committee meetings may prohibit it, but it seems like it would be nice if we could actually have this subcommittee meet before the September Ledge Days. But I know the president's office right now is probably yelling at me as I say this, trying to circumvent the Ledge Days. But I mean, that's a point, because I mean, if we have to do work on it and we do it in September, then when are we going to report it out to LCC? Is that now December?
Mr. Co-Chair, my recollection was, this is in part a reflection of the Sunshine Committee is a little bit behind where it was supposed to be, as my understanding. Cameron, is that
Their recommendations are not due till July 1st of this year. The report. So they're not really behind, but they have not reviewed any exemptions by that date. So that it'll be a schedule only and not actually a review of exemptions, is my understanding.
All right. So time management here, is there anything else on this proposal that we have besides the adding of the number 5, as we've discussed? If not, then I think you've got what you need for 111. Why don't we go ahead and jump over to 112? And Cameron, do you want to start?
So policy 142-112 establishes procedures for calculating fees for public records requests and for determining whether to grant partial or complete waivers of those fees.
All right, and Dexter?
Sure, Mr. Co-Chair, this policy, first of all, as some of the background material I've sent you explains, the current practice in the legislative branch is this very cumbersome process for determining what the fees are, where you actually identify who's going to be doing the work, what their actual compensation is, converting that to an hourly rate, determining the estimate of the number of hours, and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of effort that goes into that, and it's rather slow just getting out of the gate. And that's a problem when you have a new time frame that the 2017 legislation adopted that really creates an expectation for public bodies that from the date of request to the date of delivery of records is 15 business days. And so this policy, the first part of it, simply streamlines that process. It's modeled after the what the governor's office does, where you don't actually try and figure out who's doing what. It's based on the work, and if it's a clerical level work, it's computed at a rate of $25 an hour. If it's mid-level work that involves some level of understanding of internal business processes, internal legislative processes. That's 40. And if it's professional level work by attorneys or IT professionals or someone like that, it is $75 an hour. And that would greatly streamline the process and make it much easier for us to comply with the 15-day time frame. That's the first part of this rule, of this policy. Questions on that part? Okay, the second part is a little bit more controversial. It's the concept of a fee reduction or a waiver, and the statute authorizes that and has for years. But in the legislative branch, it's been pretty much a free-form kind of approach, and basically any legislator is free to say, yeah, no fees here, or there's a lot of discretion in what they do with fees. And this policy would at least put on the record that particular standards for when one fees are reduced by 40%. And you can see the standards there, or those circumstances where it is the request is very limited and it is narrowly tailored and meets what's called the comprehensive public interest test, that the fees are entirely waived. And so that's the kind of the second portion of that policy. Right.
So let's talk a little bit about that. What caught my ear is that is it current practice that I or any other member makes that decision as to whether there is or isn't going to be a cost?
Mr. Co-Chair, yes, that is correct. And that has exposed the legislature to some criticism when we've had these requests that are made of every legislator's office, and then it's all over the board, right, in terms of what the fee is.
Right. So I just want to kind of put some of this stuff on the record so we kind of track through this. Because to me, it seems like it needs to be uniformed, and it shouldn't be up to myself or any other member saying yes or no, because I can see where you can get contradictions, mm-hmm, for multiple reasons. And that seems to me this should go to, let's call it the clearinghouse, whoever, and I would think it would be your office, since you're the ones that coordinating and doing the work and producing the records, to make the determination whether there is or isn't a fee based on the guidelines that we give. So I'll just throw that out there for discussion. Senator Boquist.
I actually fully agree with you. We have frequent flyer requesters, and that's why I think, going back to it, I did not realize my lack of respect for good Representative Wilson that he was the co-chair over there. So as the co-chair has pointed earlier, and we've asked this question, public interest test, and this whole rate thing becomes problematic for legislative council in that, you know, we have some frequent flyer requesters, right? And they're always claiming it's in the public interest, you know, that it's the public interest, you know. And when they're making, you know, weekly public records requests, if not monthly, I think, you know, Dexter could probably guess a name right off the bat. And then, you know, some of us like, okay, I've got like six of these in the last 4 weeks from the same person. Forget it. Just charge them for whatever it is. This is stupid. Now, in my case, I see this and I still do today, and council does not like this, so I'll just put that on the record, is that, you know, I have requesters that come in to go through the process, and it's like, okay, fine, please feel free to go down and go through the process, or I will simply log you in on that computer right there, and you can just search to your heart's desire, because anything I have is a public record, and I don't care. But I think if we went to a uniform policy, as you said, Senator Brzezinski, it would be better, so that way we don't have 90 members trying to figure out what public interest is, or mm-hmm, just to be fair to the public, after they've been asked six times for the same set of records, that, you know, their level of public interest desire is not as much, because it's like, why didn't you just use the first one? So if we had a uniform policy, but I do think the only thing that jumps out of this whole policy is, once again, this whole public interest test, because again, we have a couple of individuals who are frequent flyers in a nonpartisan way, mm-hmm, to all of us.
Oh yeah.
That you know, want legislative counsel to have one full-time person to be their data expert, and we, you know, steer times with, I will agree, shortage of education dollars and other things. I mean, we should have a uniform policy and go in that direction. So I'm in support, but I do think this public interest standard still is really blurry to me, because I think I could give you all kinds of arguments that we're having behind the scenes in regards to the Oregon Homeland Security Council and emergency services and Senator Brzezinski involvement. Okay, there is like no really definitive public records exemption, but like you don't want to create certain panic situations and things. And so that public interest thing, being not being a lawyer and having not been involved in judiciary in years, thank goodness, no disrespect, I just, I see problems coming. But I'm fully supportive of your proposal and agree.
All right. So let's follow up with what Senator Boqvist has mentioned as to the public interest. That test, it would seem to me, would be at the legislative council level and not us as an individual.
Mr. Co-Chair and members, that is the way this policy is drafted. And that public interest test is something that is not new. It is in the public records law right now.
Right.
And, Cameron, did you have substantive
There's public interest tests for the fees and then public interest tests for the exemptions. And there's different public interest tests. But what this policy would allow us to do is to say, tick off and say, in our opinion, this public record request is or is not in the public interest and should or should not be granted a waiver. It doesn't give us that authority to make that decision for you, but it at least gives us standards and allow us to give you our opinion of whether it should be waived or should be charged.
All right. We'll follow up, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I'm with you on this one.
I mean, I hate to tell you, I mean, the battle banners just went up, okay? The bannermen are out here. I read this as saying, you're going to say this is the fee and this is what we're going to do. I think what I just heard you say, though, is you're now going to still go back to 90 members and say this is our recommendation. Is this a definitive policy? It's 25, 40, 75, and this is what we should do? Or are you going to come back to us and make a recommendation again and we've changed nothing?
Mr. Chair, Senator Boqvist, my understanding of this is that this is what we would do.
Okay.
So this would not be a going back and forth to members, with the caveat that staff is, this isn't our role, is to police. And so we will enforce this, and this is why we're asking for actual legislative adoption of this policy, so we can point to it in talking to members about what's going to happen. But I do know in certain requests, a member could easily say, I'm going to send it to them anyways, and that will happen.
Right. Well, that's something you don't have the control over.
Yeah.
In the sense of if I mean, I guess we can make it different in the sense of if a public records request came to one individual member versus all 90 members, it still seems to me that we would want a uniformity default.
Yeah,
as compared to saying that it's now the member's obligation or decision to how this is going to be handled. It seems to me that when a request comes into my office or any of the other three up here or all of our offices, the default should be going to LC. So we have uniformity, consistency, because I could see where on an individual basis, X number say give it to them or does give it to them, as compared to the Y group doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
I think for simplicity for everybody in the process and for the general public, consistency of having one means for how that this is dealt with. And I'm trying to think that in the times where I've had public records requests filed in my office, I think we always have pushed it to LC to work through. And so wouldn't we just continue to do that and just formalize that those requests are administratively handled by LC, and that the decisions that we're being passed with these proposal for policies would give that uniformity that you would be making those decisions and not us?
Yeah. Yeah. Mr. Chair, that is our recommendation too.
Okay. So
I want to follow up for the record, and I'll use a real world example, because I want to solidify what I think, at least I saw two heads nod, maybe three, sorry, Representative, whether you did or didn't, but I'll just give you an example, and as Dexter's familiar with this, and you know, I don't get, well, I probably get a lot of media requests, and my media request is like, okay, look, I can search for Billy Bob Thornton press deal and print it for you, but I can't keep my computer running on a daily basis, and Steve's in my office every other day getting the thing back running. So if I'm doing a search, it's totally meaningless, okay? And likewise, you know, my legislative staff is just one slightly step beyond Excel spreadsheets. So if they do a search, they might have found one more document than I have, and there could be 75 more in there. So I automatically, by default, first thing when somebody calls us, say, hey, you want to come in and look at the computer, I'll log you in, I'm fine, right? If you want to do a formal search, I ain't doing it because I might give you six of 29 unintentionally, and I automatically go to LC and say, okay, if they want to do it, you need to bring someone from IT up here, and they need to do the search, not me. I don't care what they get. I really don't care because it's public record. But the bottom line is I can't even find emails I sent 3 days ago in this system. And I want to ensure if we're going to do this, because what happens now is they come back and say, well, your staff's going to go search. I think we should have a uniform policy for the public to say that if it is a bona fide request, LC says it's a bona fide request, that the public knows that someone with more capability than me with IT experience and LC experience is going to do a thorough search, so that 6 months from now, Representative Wilson and I aren't standing 2 weeks before the election and they're waving this document out and saying we hid it from them because we couldn't even find it ourselves. And so I'm hoping that's the direction we're going with this uniformity. And I think from the Sunshine Committee and the previous stuff, people are wanting to know that when they do a public records request, that there's actually a thorough search done, not one done by me or somebody else. And I think that's the direction we're going, and I'm hearing. But I do know today it's the typical ping is, hey, is your staff going to go look for this? Well, my staff can't turn the computer on.
Yeah, but my understanding, I think from my previous ones, LC coordinates with IS. They do their search, then they come back to us and say, here's the documents we found. Do you claim any privilege?
Yeah, Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Boquist, that's correct.
That's what I want us to do, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that is correct. Once we're aware of a request, this is the process that we use. And the challenge is sometimes we aren't aware of them. Request is made of a particular individual
right.
member. Mm-hmm. They handle it. That's that.
Yeah, so that goes back to the example if someone sends us something, hey, I'd like to have whatever document you have on this, and we tell our staff or we push the button, send it to them, you never see it, it's been done,
mm-hmm.
and then it's over. But in a formal process, then hopefully the member is utilizing the services that we have available to us, because I think your example, Senator Boquist, is appropriate that you basically, in good faith, do what you think you needed to do, but whoops.
Right.
Yeah.
I can't find emails that disappeared this week, let alone anything. I would suggest co-chairs, and ask, you know, as we move forward into whether it's September or November, that we just do a little bit of wordsmithing in this process so the public knows that somebody who's competent is going to do the search. It's not like, okay, the member staff or whatever. And that has sort of been the complaint that we have heard that has led to some of the negativities from some of the folks that are in the room right now, in that, you know, okay, we got this request, and, you know, once again, we didn't get the record, but we know it exists. I have learned a long time ago in my line of work, you always ask for the record from the public records request because you already have it. You're just checking to see if they're honest. And so I would ask a little wordsmithing that at least in some places clarified to the public that, you know, there is a uniform policy and a uniform set of professionals that are doing this.
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Boquist, that we can certainly include that in there. One of the implications of the policy, one of the earlier policies that the LCC has already adopted, is that you haven't actually made an official public records request unless it goes to our office. And so that kind of dovetails with that.
All right, so I think to cover that, Dexter, it would seem that if we're going to put something like that in there, we need to qualify that as a official public records request.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I mean, what I don't want to see us do is that anytime someone asks us for something, we have a duty, an obligation, to to have LC be brought into this, because we're going to have an energy time
exactly
drain that just wouldn't be, for me, the merit isn't there as compared to when a official request comes, we need to have a uniform way that all of us can be handled.
Yeah.
So
we will include that, and just to some degree, the other policy already provides for that.
Okay. So as we had stated during our earlier conversation, Dexter and his team will modify these two policies. What I think would be appropriate is if you could then send them out to the committee, of course, with the postings and everything else, just so we can look at and make sure they read the way we think, the way we intend them to be, and that way we can make certain we're ready to report out a finished product to the LCC to be able to take up on a formal basis.
Mm-hmm. When is that, Secretary? Do we decide December or September, or we're going to sandbag and meet earlier?
I think we're going to see how this plays out. I would anticipate September as the earliest, but it may be we can get special
permission
from both the leadership sides to let us meet pre-ledge days if necessary.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Or a coffee meeting in the room at 7 o'clock before we do the other one.
True.
I'm game.
Yeah.
I'm fine.
We can do that too. That's probably what, now that you've suggested, that's probably what we'll be doing.
Because it'll be outside the schedule. Welcome to Transportation, Revenue, and Judiciary. There you go, right? Meeting full time.
All right. Anything else for the good? Dexter, what else do you need from
us? I just wanted to note, I know we are out of time, so the other document, the two more not formed policies, we'll just carry them over to the next meeting, or I certainly welcome any input that you have individually on those as well.
This is the policy topic one?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there are two. One is about the it's very similar. It's about how much latitude is there in claiming the in-session exemption when you have requests made of multiple members and the in-session exemption is available. And then the other one is simply more of a to facilitate prompt resolution of records, what to do when there is a legislator who isn't being responsive to our outreach to them. And those are of all of the what we've talked about, those are the more most controversial, so that probably warrants further discussion at a later date.
Well, what do you think? I mean, do you want to take a few more minutes and look at this?
I'm fine taking a few more minutes. I've just been in transportation listening to the ODOT director, so I'm fine being here.
Yeah.
He's in my office weekly now. I don't need to see him anymore.
So if we put a time limit, let's say up to 12:15, that should give people hopefully opportunity to get something to eat before their afternoons or go back to transportation.
Oh, I'm in session right now. I'm stacked four deep, one right after the next. I'm on a diet anyway.
So why don't we just go ahead and just look at these real quick, Dexter, and see if we can't help give you some guidance.
Okay. I appreciate that, Mr. Chair and members. The first topic, Cameron, did you?
Sure. It's whether when we have ordinary session, the legislators can invoke the in-session exemption to be exempt from public records request. Depending on the workload of the staff and the size of the request, certain members will take or not take it, which opens up the legislature for some claims of inappropriateness when different people are responding differently to that request.
All right. I'm going to throw out, it seems to me we again need something uniform, and it seems very simple to say that when we are in session that there's a delay. I just don't see it playing out other ways, because we've seen in a sense where it does in fact bog down the ability for us to do the work that we're supposed to be doing during a session. And you think about historically, there has been the prohibition of taking action against a member, delaying them from being able to get the session to be able to do their work. And so it seems to me that that would be a reasonable way to ensure we don't have some type of tactic used to bog people's offices down. And it seems to me, I know that that's an individual choice that one member can make versus another one may not. Maybe that's the controversy, is that I wanted to get out as compared to making them wait until we finish our session. Senator Boquist, then.
Well, I think co-chair should go first. He's the ranking member.
All right, co-chair Wilson.
Hey, I was just going to ask, as we look at the Constitution in the beginning that allowed for this, what do we think they had in mind when writing the Constitution on this particular issue? I mean, times are obviously different in many ways. The information much more profuse today than then, but what was behind that?
So, Co-Chair Wilson, members, the provision is actually one that it is in many constitutions. It goes back centuries, and I had the occasion to look at the meaning and the Constitution, the constitutional meaning in a different context, and it really was designed to protect. It's a separation of powers concept. It was designed to protect the legislature so that the executive couldn't interfere with the legislature coming together by arresting everybody or that sort of thing, or making it very difficult to actually meet. And so that is why the provision says that during session in the 15 days preceding, the legislature is exempt from civil process. Now, the public records law has a definition of state agency that incorporates that concept and says state agency doesn't mean the legislature, its committees, members, and staff when this provision of the Constitution applies. So it's bootstrapped on that. Mm-hmm. And I think that was adopted in the late 1970s. So I think it was the legislature at that time making a policy decision to have a public records exemption available and writing it in a way that is unusual compared with other public records exemptions.
I see about three things that play into this. I mean, I think I'm with Senator Brzezinski, and we need one standard, and this is sort of why. First off, is it no difference? I mean, we're in a deliberative body in which, you know, we're drafting legislation, whether it's 1859 and we rode 10 days here on our horse or whatever it is. And so the ability to have that deliberativeness between the body, I think, also applies into the civil procedures back then in court cases. Because, back then you got 25 people together, and if one of them got drug out and we had to wait for a quorum or we had to wait for him to come back, I mean, everybody else is sitting around here at the local tavern down here, and of course, then there's still the 7-day ride back on your horse the other direction. And so, and we've actually come full circle back to the 7-day, 10-day horse ride problem, and that is the plethora of data we have now can bury, in a public records request, the entire legislature and bring us to a stop, just like they can auto-dial our phones and melt them down. And I think one of equity and fairness then plays into this because, I mean, while we could say we're going to do this and that, if, you know, Bob Smith makes a public records request and it's one page and we know it's real quick, should we treat him any different than Betty Jones, who wants 65 pages? And so we really need to have one set standard policy. And even if you do a set standard policy like this, if the Bob Smith request comes to you as a legislator, and it routinely does to all of our offices, like the media says, well, you know, what did they say, or what does that say? I mean, the member still is at liberty themselves as an individual to hit the print button or forward them the email. And so there still is something at the member level. But if we don't have a uniform policy in which, in fiscal and austere times and so much massive data out there, I mean, now when we're doing these public records requests, as council knows, it's text and email and phone log and schedule and all just to find out what the topic was. We need a uniform one, and really it's a case of, like, everybody needs them to be on the same sheet of music, because if one person was allowed to tell LC, yes, go do this, and I'll just give you an example, it turned out to be the Transportation Committee and the drafting documents. I mean, we were at 400 and some pages in three versions at one time. So uniformity is the key thing here. And the exemption can be done by the personal member in their own office outside the formal process. And I do this text notice routinely. They'll get me, media will come in and say, hey, look, I'll just print it for you. Or if you want to go through the formal process, more power to you.
Any feedback, Dexter?
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair, thank you. With having a uniform process, one of the things that could happen is when you have a very bona fide media request that comes in during session, and there is, let's say, not a whole, all 90 members, but 10 members of a committee. Under this policy, it would, if any one member said, oh, I don't want to, I'm going to claim the exemption under the policy, it would apply to all and potentially delay things for 5 months. That's a big, heavy duty outcome.
Let me follow up to that though, counsel. Let's just say one of them says we're going to claim the exemption and all 10 members are in the exemption. There is nothing to prevent, you know, the Oregonian, because I'll use transportation because it's like all over the place, is from them going to single member and say, I want to see a doctor. And the single member without a formal request, as you have pointed out, providing them. And once again, I don't really care that it's the media either, you know, no disrespect to them, but if it's something that's, as you point out, is going to bog down the committee and the entire process, that becomes, you know, problematic in itself. Is that in the public interest to, you know, bring a committee to this, to a dead stop? And I'm happy to argue with the media that, and I'm also happy to sit them down on my term where they can have access. But I do see what you're saying, and some members can do it. But I think, generally speaking now, most members that I know of, at least on the Senate side, we are so busy that when it comes to, you know, like, I can't dig through 25 emails, even if IT doesn't says go look at these. I don't have time to look at them. I just don't have time. It has nothing to do whether it's right or wrong for the request. It's the time. And, you know, my district is pretty solid. Every day we're in here is a bad news, and every day I can leave, I can get reelected. So I mean, maybe the House has a different perspective over there, but.
In this day and age, I'd be interested to know, is there a kind of request, or is there a scenario of many requests where the system can be totally bogged down?
Chair Wilson, I think it turns on what you mean by system. I think we in legislative council have capacity to we have had capacity to deal with everything we've faced. Mm-hmm. I can envision some kind of a request, but it would, I mean, this is why the fees factor into it. If you have a very expansive request and doesn't seem to be a very good reason,
yeah,
for it, then you're going to charge. I mean, it will be very expensive to proceed.
Yeah.
All right. So I don't know if we're going to be able to reach conclusions on this.
Yeah.
It seems to me that I'm going to request, Dexter, that you and Cameron work through these two, maybe flesh them out a little bit more, mm-hmm, and give us some, I guess, some perspective of what you see or how you think we might want to address it,
mm-hmm,
with examples or process. And then what, at that 7 o'clock meeting we're doing, we could potentially look at it like that.
Mr. Chair, that sounds like
I think there's more time than we have to,
yeah,
really hone in on this. And maybe the work that you get back to us will give us a little more clarity. And just then I guess I'm just going to ask, so we have clarification on this, if you send stuff out to us, would you prefer or advise us not to respond back to you with comments and stuff to be in consideration, or is that something that, as long as it's done openly, it's in the computer system, it's open for review, or do you want us to just ponder and then wait until we're back and reorganized?
Mr. Co-Chair and members, actually, because this is legislative council, it's not disclosable.
Okay.
So the one thing to be mindful of, and this is why I will, we will send you everything just individually, is not to not to deliberate via email.
Right.
That becomes one of those
non-open
meetings. But otherwise, no, I would welcome your comments.
Okay.
I don't know what we're deliberating, so don't worry about that.
All right. Anything else that we need to do?
Nope.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Patsy. Thank you for covering us. Cameron, welcome aboard.
Thank you.
Dexter, as always.
Thank you, members.